From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We humans are a hungry species. We chomp through a heck of a lot of this planet's plants and animals. We are nearly 7 billion bellies to fill today. We're headed for 9 billion, maybe beyond. That is a challenge to feed. My guest today says it's going to take more than farmers' markets and organic goodwill. It's going, he says, to take science and maybe a shocking stretch of our palates. Test tubes, bugs, things you've never eaten. This hour on Point, one man's dispatches from the future of food. You can join the conversation. Do you think 9 billion people can eat like you eat today? Do you think we'll be able to feed the planet without a lot more science on our plates? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Chicago is Josh Schoenwald, a journalist who's done a lot of research into what tomorrow will taste like. He's got his own aquaponic farm in the basement where he raises butter lettuce, arugula, and one day soon, tilapia fish for his family's dinner table. And he's got a new book out called The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food. Josh, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
So there's a lot to talk about here, but just start us with maybe some broad sketch of a menu. It's 2035, a year you're kind of hooked onto. What's for dinner, Josh?
Well, in the prologue of the book, which you described a little bit in the intro, I foreshadowed a couple of different foods that may not be here now, which might be a bigger part of the future. And that drawed on a lot of the research I did for the book, such as one of the things that I anticipate is an influx of foods from sub-Saharan Africa. Based on the trends that I discovered in my book, there's going to be a continuing appetite for new ethnic foods, and inevitably that's going to bring us to a place that is virtually off the culinary frontier right now. So that's why I highlighted a few items from sub-Saharan Africa on the menu.
As a matter of taste or a matter of ecology? You're paying a lot of attention to global ecology and the Earth's capacity, sort of carrying capacity for food production here, but African, sub-Saharan African sounds more like a matter of what our desire for novelty or something new.
Well, absolutely. My book did focus not only on sustainability but also just broadly on a series of searches for different aspects of what could be on the menu of the future. One of them is a change in cuisine. Some of the other items that I included in my sort of preview of the future included fish raised in an indoor system. A big concern in the world of seafood production is, of course, how are we going to respond to this soaring need for seafood, soaring appetite. At the same time, there's limited resources. If everyone in the world wants wild-caught fish, we will have no fish. So in the book, I eventually focused on one method of aquaculture, which is growing in popularity, and that is growing fish indoors in a recirculating system. So in my sort of future view, I envisioned a scenario in which it could be grown indoors.
Factories all over the place and very far from open water, certainly far from oceans.
Yes, absolutely. Right now in the United States, something like 90% of our seafood is imported. There are a lot of virtues to bringing fish farming indoor. And I'm never suggesting that this is the silver bullet, that this is the end of wild-caught fisheries or ecologically sensitive aquaculture in the oceans. Mm-hmm. But just as part of the menu of technologies used to sate our seafood appetite indoors, inland, one of the virtues is it doesn't do. It doesn't cause fish escapes, or it doesn't have an impact on the marine ecology.
Fish waste messing up whole bays and all that. I mean, you remind us that tastes do change. In 2000, the average American didn't know what tilapia was, and 5 years later, it's a fixture at Red Lobster and Costco. You're looking at cobia as the next big and super fast reproducing fish.
Absolutely.
Growing, I should say.
I mean, in Cobia was patient zero of the book. You know, I had, you know, as I, you know, when I'm not a food writer. I hadn't had a burning passion in the future of food. I'd, you know, written a restaurant review or two in college. But what I discovered in 2005, I met an aquaculture researcher who made the claim that he'd found the perfect species, which is cobia, and that it would be as popular as salmon within 5 years. Now, clearly that hasn't happened. Tom, have you seen cobia up in Boston?
I haven't had it on my menu yet, but maybe it's on the way.
One of the things, cobia, part of the reason why it has been talked about as such a having so much potential as the next big fish is because it grows incredibly fast. You know, six times as fast as salmon. It behaves bizarrely well in captivity, which is critical for aquaculture. You know, you can't take a tiger. That's the reason why we're not eating tigers. And the same is true for the aquaculture world. Like a fish like mahi-mahi doesn't lend itself to cage. And it also has a taste that a lot of people compare to halibut or Chilean sea bass. So it's this neutral tasting white fish that's perfect for aquaculture. And many people in the aquaculture world viewed it as having tremendous potential.
Super fast growing. You can grow it in your basement. So there it is on our 2035 table alongside some agusi soup or Zanzibari pizza or baobab juice from sub-Saharan Africa. You point to a future, Josh, where there's going to be plenty of genetic engineering involved in part to get more nutrients into the food that we do eat because it's going to be a challenge to produce enough nutrients in the food overall. I mean, you've got, cherry tomatoes with lemon basil flavor in them. You've got blue bananas, and you've got a lot of things, foods we know, but that would be enhanced with the kind of enhanced nutritional oof from science.
Yes. My position on genetically engineered foods is that it shouldn't be so black and white. You know, it shouldn't be no GMOs. It shouldn't be all GMOs. There are some smart applications of genetically engineered crops that could do a lot of good. I first just want to say that because it's such a third rail issue for a lot of people. But I do believe that there is a lot of potential both for improving, protecting the environment, humanitarian applications, crops like golden rice, which is, you know, nearing availability, where a vitamin-enhanced crop could do a great deal of good for malnourished people in Asia. And in the, you know, my foreshadowing of the future, you know, I envision a point at which, you know, the world begins to embrace the potential of bioengineered crops. You know, my initial curiosity in all of this, you know, began from a position of skepticism. You know, I've certainly thought that the idea of taking bacteria and putting it into a tomato was kind of creepy. And I certainly had heard, you know, watched documentaries and, you know, seen Monsanto terrorizing small farmers. And, you know, but my intent was to see, you know, what the culinary potential of so-called Frankenfood was. And you, Tom, had mentioned this lemon basil cherry tomato. That was really what set me off on this quest.
Sometimes just for flavor, sort of bake the dressing right into genetically into the tomato itself.
Yeah, and you know, I had read a Scientific American article about a team of Israeli researchers that took a gene from a lemon basil plant and inserted it into a cherry tomato, and it did very well in a taste test. And so that spurred my curiosity, is there more of this out there? You know, genetic engineering for flavor, the Ferran Adrias, if you will, of the farm. And there currently isn't a lot of that going on. You know, most of it is for large-scale commodity crops.
But you predict it will
be.
Yeah, in the future. And then take us before the break here to the next sort of platter on the table in 2035, and you're saying, hey, folks, we're going to have stem cell hamburgers.
I do. I do believe that inevitably we'll see stem cell hamburgers.
Meaning test tube bioreactor grown meat?
Test tube bioreactor. Sometimes it's called cultured meat, lab grown meat. Given the world's meat appetite and given the resources that exist in the world, something's got to give. And, you know, I don't think that in vitro meat is going to be the end-all solution. I think we'll see more plant-based alternatives to meat, and I think we'll see a growing vegetarian diet. But I absolutely am enthusiastic about the idea of growing, you know, taking a single stem cell and culturing it and creating meat that doesn't require, you know, land. I think 30% – this may be an imprecise stat, but something like 30% of the Earth's land is used for animal livestock farming.
You're talking that's a huge burden on the Earth, and you're talking about the 2035 waitress maybe saying, you know, well, hey, what would you like for meat? You know, bison, chicken, pork, cow, and saying we've got an excellent meat grower bioreactor, not pasture. Do you think people will get over? I mean, and we've seen headlines recently saying there's research going on this right now, and they're making progress. Are humans going to loosen up their sense of, you know, what's palatable and just eat what extrudes from the test tube there?
I think, you know, inevitably when I talk with people about, you know, my interest in lab-grown meat, the word yuck comes up. You know, there's a tremendous yuck factor. But when you start comparing it to the default, which is concentrated animal feedlots, you know, pumping animals with antibiotics and growth promoters, they start to warm to the idea of meat grown indoors that doesn't produce greenhouse gas emissions.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the future of food, or one man's view of it anyway, and new directions it may take on a crowded, hungry planet. Josh Schoenwald is with us from Chicago, writer, journalist, and indoor aquaponic farmer himself. His new book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And he says, look, it's going to take a lot of science, in fact, whether we like it or not, when we've got 9 billion people to bring nutrition to all those people, and it's going to look different. Josh, in Chicago, here's Mary writing to us online, lots of people writing, but she says, in a perfect world, I think the future of food would look more like the past. What do you say to that, Josh?
I agree with Mary. I think that it would be great if we could have a idyllic return to that era. However, you know, there have been so many changes in the world in terms of soaring population and diminished resources. I think that, you know, just in pure pragmatism, in order to respond to our needs, that there is an important role for smart science and technology.
What can we hang on to, and how much are we going to have to, by your lights, get rid of? I mean, it will be the biggest population burden the planet has ever had of humans. So how radically do you see that, you know, remaking diets, cuisines, and will it remake everybody's or some people's? How do you look at that?
Well, in the, you know, sort of conclusion of the book, I make the claim that Michael Pollan is 75% right. You know, what has happened over the past 10 or 15 years, the food revolution, you know, a return to, you know, a stronger connection to our local food sources, a move towards more natural ingredients, a skepticism of health claims from large corporations, less use of chemicals in agriculture. That is all overwhelmingly wonderful, and I'm totally supportive of the trend. I'm just saying that this shouldn't result in a, you know, categorical skepticism of technology and science. I'm saying, you know, just because there were some, you know, the processed food has caused an obesity epidemic with kids, that doesn't mean that processed food is categorically bad, or just because of the excesses of bad conventional aquaculture doesn't mean we should pull away from aquaculture, or for that matter, even genetic engineering. You know, it has to be looked situationally, you know, and the technology has to be looked individually for what it can do because of the need.
I guess part of what I'm asking there is, you know, will affluent nations be exempt from radical diet changes? Will this be like for somebody else? This will be for countries that are so poor they've got to eat, they've got to scratch it up from whatever's available, and if it's only tested, or will this be, you know, through a combination of evolving tastes and acceptance levels, will this be all over the world? You know, North America, Europe, rich China at that point, is everybody going to be partaking in the changes in diet that you're describing here?
Well, that, Tom, is a little bit out of, you know, the scope of, like, what I looked at in the book, you know, in terms of, like, making any, like, general comment on you know, but what I can say is that I do think that it will be specific to one's class and place. You know, certainly, you know, part of the reason why a lot of people may not feel an imperative to eat genetically engineered crops is because they don't have to. You know, if there's one thing, if you're a middle or upper middle class American or European, it's another thing if you're someone in sub-Saharan Africa. You simply don't have to eat bioengineered crops, and it's hard for me to say in the future, if you will. I mean, there still will be a class of people who can, you know, elect to eat only wild-caught fish and only organic vegetables. It's very specific to one's own economics.
But it's funny how once the base of food starts changing, and then presto, you've got tilapia showing up in the finest restaurant, and off we go. We're on a new beam, and who knows where that may be. Nashville, Tennessee. John is calling. John, you're on the air with Josh Schoenwald.
Hi, Tom. Great topic.
Great.
My question is, I teach survival to Boy Scouts, and just recently this topic came up where I was telling them about how we have so many edible wild greens and edible wild plants here in Tennessee, dandelions, plantain, wild chicory.
Sure.
And my scouts actually said, how in the world do we have world hunger if there are so many of these things? Just, you know, when people spend millions of dollars across the country to get rid of them out of their grass.
Yeah.
And here are all these wild foods that are quite edible, quite good. They're good for you. And we just completely disregard them. And I'll take my answer off the air.
It's a great point, John. And keep teaching that survival. Josh, I mean, dandelions, plantain, wild hickory, this is right up your alley, Josh.
Yeah, Tom and John, one of the questions that fascinated me when I started this book is the possibility that something that is currently viewed as a weed, if a weed could become discovered and eventually part of the mainstream, i.e. making it to the shelves of Safeway. You know, we're starting to see more and more of an interest in foraging and wild plants. You know, if you go to a good farmer's market, you'll see many options. You'll see the sort of the answer in my search, I ultimately culminated that in that I thought that one plant that is currently viewed as a weed has such appeal that it will make it to the mainstream, and that is purslane. Tom, are you familiar at all with
this
purslane?
Well, I mean, through you I am. This is this kind of a peppery, lemony, paddle-shaped leaf. It's kind of mucilaginous, like okra, kind of chewy,
yeah,
slimy. Why this one? Where does it grow?
Purslane is, I believe, the scourge, a problem for a lot of farmers and lawn owners. You know, certainly, you know, generally in North America, at least, view it as a weed. But
you say Alice Waters loves it, and Gandhi apparently loves it.
Said to be Gandhi's favorite vegetable.
Okay. Also known as hogweed. People may know it that way.
Right. So it does have some negative sounding aliases, but purslane, you know, has a very neutral flavor. It's got this great kind of texture and, you know, this okra quality. So it's a very appealing. You know, makes a great salad with just a little olive oil and some sea salt. And the reason why I think, though, that purslane, of all the weeds that and wild greens that foragers are discovering, is destined for greatness is because of its health qualities. It has more omega-3 fatty acids than any other leafy green. It's loaded with beta carotene, I believe like seven times more than carrots. It is, you know, I think it's destined to be the next superfood.
That sounds pretty good. And how's it taste? I mean, I like okra, so it's mucilaginous doesn't bug me, I guess, but how's it taste?
Very, very faint mucilaginous.
Okay.
So it's got a very neutral flavor, and it's distinctive, and it's crunchy, and Alice Waters is onto it, so there must be, you know, some appeal. She's a good arbiter of taste.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So there's some here is going to be about stretching our palate to purslane and Kobe and things we just don't eat now. Some of this about science and getting a lot of more than we might delightfully imagine genetics involved. Leon in Burlington, Vermont. Leon, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My thought about a lot of this is we should be paying farmers to plant their fields, not keep them unplanted. Hydroponics is a wonderful thing. If we get chemical plants involved, for those of us that remember it, we'll be eating like the Jetsons. We'll get up every morning, take a little pill, and they'll do whatever they want and tell us it's good for us.
How's that sound to you? It sounds like that doesn't look so tasty to you, Leon.
No, it doesn't.
You want something you can put a knife and fork in. So what about the science part of what Josh is laying out? Are you open to that in part, a little, or not at all?
Some, but when you look at things and read, the chemical companies have already killed 90% of the dirt in this country. You can fly in the air and see green, and you can see a darker green where the people are more of an organic farmer.
Yeah.
The soil and a lot of the farms, because they're dependent on chemical companies, is dead. There's no microbes. There's nothing in the ground. Very shortly, that ground won't produce any food.
Leon, we've got that perspective. I mean, Josh, you know what fierce, deep pushback there is when you start talking about chemicals and food together, genetics and food together, Roundup and all the rest. Do you think that's going to change, Josh, under population pressure, or is just always going to be there?
It really depends on what day you ask me. I mean, because you see the popularity of the GMO labeling campaign, you see it's very strong. However, you know, I am hopeful that people will see that there are certain applications of genetic engineering, whether it is a humanitarian crop like golden rice that can help, you know, people in need in parts of the world that are malnourished, or the environmental virtues. You know, Leon had pointed out that, some genetically engineered crops are supporting the use of more chemicals, Roundup Ready crop, mm-hmm. designed to support Roundup Ready. Others reduce the use of chemicals in agriculture. It's some GMO crops are good, some are bad. I just think that people should look at it, look at the technology on a situational basis. One of the greatest promises of bioengineering, in my view, is the possibility of reducing nitrogen in agriculture. Nitrogen runoff is one of the biggest sources of problems in the creation of dead zones.
Gulf of Mexico and right on around the world. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing on the horizon could be the possibility of minimizing nitrogen in, more nitrogen efficient crops. That would have a wonderfully positive effect on the environment. So I think that, if you look at the potential, we shouldn't turn our back. We shouldn't just be categorically like there have been problems with, the patent, and, it's been controlled by agribusiness. But don't just say, okay, we've got this new technology. It has problems. Let's turn our backs on it.
Josh Schoenwald says we're going to have to pay attention in new ways as the population explodes on this planet. Josh, stand by in Chicago if you'd be good enough. Kurt Timmermeister joins us right now from Vashon Island, Washington State, outside of Seattle. Founder of Kurtwood Farms, a dairy farm on Vashon Island, specializes in cheese production, wonderful local dinners that he puts out there. Author of Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Kurt, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you again.
Tom, thank you. It's good to be here.
So what do you think of this? So the population is growing. People say it's going to go to 9 billion, maybe to 10 billion. And Josh says that is going to require a changed palate and a changed attitude towards science in our food. You're right there next to the land and producing great stuff all the time. What do you make of that perspective, Kurt?
I can go for the purslane. I like purslane, except when it's in my garden, but that I can certainly support. Supporting large agricultural companies to provide food for most of the planet, I just can't support that. I think we should support the farmers who are on the ground throughout the world, who have local interests, local knowledge, who can feed the people in their area. I think that's where there's a great future. The idea of having Monsanto control the food supply of sub-Saharan Africa, I mean, that just scares me. I think they haven't done a good job. I think they've had tremendous problems with crops like Roundup Ready. I don't want to give them the control to the food supply.
And that's before we get to test tube meats. But, Josh, what about that? Just give it over to local farmers. They're near the population. Let them grow it. And whatever they come up with, that'll be local and sort of by definition fresh and good. And you've got your solution. What do you say to that perspective, Josh?
Well, Tom, I think, and Kurt, I think two things. First, the technology is not inherently for agribusiness or monoculture or corporate use. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems with the perception of genetic engineering. You know, overwhelmingly, that's the case. So far,
well, they own a lot of patents. You don't see a lot of organic farmers doing stem cell hamburgers out of the back.
But instead of saying genetic engineering is bad, and let's turn away from it and use conventional plant breeding methods, I think it should be the focus on improving the use of genetic engineering.
What's the problem with conventional, old-fashioned, small, local farming and feed the world?
It's great. And it should be continued, but there is potential to do things using biotechnology in creating, for instance, the banana. You know, there's a virus which could wipe out the banana, and the one option to protect it, the Sigatoka virus, I might be getting that wrong, I apologize, mm-hmm. Would be through using bacteria to inoculate the banana against this virus.
Kurt Timmermeister, what if it's not Monsanto? What if it's you? You know, in your operation, integrating some genetically engineered food products, I don't know what to call them, I don't know, stem cell hamburgers.
I think if it was the extension colleges giving advice to farmers and doing research and helping them, I think that's a conceivable option. I think where there's a financial incentive for the developers of the GMOs and so on, they own the patents, they want to be paid for it, and they want to control it. I think if it was an open source policy, that's a completely different thing. I still wouldn't go for it necessarily, but it's the financial end of it, the control, that is the problem.
I mean, Josh, you make the case that conventional or at least old-fashioned farming is just in many ways going to be too onerous for the earth to support, that there's an environmental problem with it, Josh.
I don't necessarily say that. I don't believe that conventional agriculture is...
Well,
I mean,
right now has got a lot of feedlots and a lot of grain.
Okay,
that goes
conventional
to just start
animal
there.
Livestock. Okay, mm-hmm. Animal livestock, either in a plant science context. Yes, I do think that we need to look at a agriculture 2.0 and to begin looking at how technology can be used to have a lesser impact on the environment and more productive. But one of the things that I think is so important, though, is to just wrest out this idea that a technology is exclusively in the hands of large corporations. Genetic engineering should be able to help small and local farmers like your guest.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of food. Josh Schoenwald is with us. His new book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food, and you can read a bit of it at our website, onpointradio.org. Joins us from Chicago, from Vashon Island. For a few more minutes, we're lucky enough to have Kurt Timmermeister with us, founder of Kurtwood Farms there. Does a lot of great raising of delicious food and making and serving of delicious food there. He's author of Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the land. I mean, people really respond when you talk about food. One listener online says, hot grilled bioreactor burger with engineered biofat, special sauce, syntho fries, cooked in silicon oil. My stomach is growling. But we don't, of course, really believe it. Solly says, I'm a little perturbed this discussion is being framed as people having to eat weird things. Here in America, we've gotten really spoiled because we've been able to turn up our nose at foods the rest of the world still consumes regularly and even holds sacred, like foraged plants, organ meats, and insects. She says, if we weren't so caught up in the idea of always eating the same cuts of meat and demanding a, you know, same produce all year round, we wouldn't have this problem. I mean, Kurt, can you see with population pressure on food supplies, Americans' palates changing in significant ways about the range of things they're prepared to eat and enjoy, Kurt?
I think we could open up our palates a little bit. We eat a great deal of food here at this farm because we slaughter the animals and we eat all the organ meats and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think the rest of the country could open up a little more. I don't think that's going to necessarily solve a big part of the problem, but I really wouldn't want to go to in vitro meats as a possible way of feeding this planet.
I mean, you might not want to do it at your farm, but what if, you know, other parts of the world need protein even after we've got sort of insect protein on the menu and all the rest, cobia in the fish tank? What if they still don't have enough protein or they don't have the taste for it? They say, you know, hey, we're middle class now and we want to eat more than lentils.
I think we should give more credit to the farmers around the world. They can find solutions, great solutions. They're on the ground. They know the region. They know the climate. And they're very resourceful, and they will find ways to feed their people. I think the idea that these farmers aren't good enough and that it's only up to Monsanto to save us, I think, is ludicrous. And I think it's a sad assessment. I think the farmers should be given much more credit for their skills.
Kurt Timmermeister, one of those farmers, author of Growing a Farmer, founder of Kurtwood Farms on Vashon Island in Washington State. Kurt, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Josh, here we've got Tanisha writing us online, and she kind of echoes that. She says, look, there's more than enough food on this planet, even for the 7 billion that we just hit. It's just not getting to those who need it. What about that view that, look, if we just farm well and wisely and distribute well, we don't need to go off sort of to the ends of the earth or our palates to make this work, Josh?
There are many ways that we can improve efficiency and increase output. In the Taste of Tomorrow, I am suggesting that there are some technologies that we should take a closer look at. I don't disagree that there are ways to improve getting food to people on the planet through access. I'm just suggesting let's also consider these other options, such as, you know, and Kurt was saying, you know, two things. One is that he doesn't want to go down the road of in vitro meat. He doesn't have to, but in vitro meat could take the weight off of the land and could, you know, foster an environment that's positive for him. Secondly, this whole perception that which, you know, I think is this sort of neo-Luddism in parts of the food movement is that, you know, these technologies are solely in the hands of Monsanto. That has to be, you know, if there's any message that I hope is, you know, sent from my book, it's that, you know, that it shouldn't be that way. You know, these, you know, technologies like genetic engineering, like aquaponics, like or aquaculture should be also viewed as potential for small-scale agriculture and food production.
Hmm. Let's go to Lucius in Brookline, Massachusetts. Lucius, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a research scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I grow tissue culture cells as part of my work,
okay,
not for people to eat, but as for research purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And based on my experience, I want to inject a healthy dose of skepticism about whether this is going to be any good for feeding people.
You mean in vitro meat?
Never mind the palatability factor. Never mind the health factor. It just economically isn't going to work. Because when you're growing animal cells in tissue culture,
mm-hmm,
you have to use media, which is going to be either made from other organisms or even more expensively from synthetic products. And in that medium, either you've got to include animal serum, which means you've got to grow a lot of animals anyway,
mm-hmm,
or you have to include even more expensive synthetic substitutes for the serum. And the market, and the reason I'm saying more expensive is from personal experience with market price.
Right, right.
And you have to use quite a lot of liquid, this medium, to grow just a tiny little bit of cells, either a really thin film or a mm-hmm. tiny pellet in the bottom of the tube.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just not going to work out as a practical means of feeding people. At most, it may end up being a novelty item for the rich, but it sure isn't going to be a way to feed the world.
That's interesting. Josh, what do you say? Here's Lucius. He's sort of in the research and says test tube meat, the economics of it just don't add up. You're not going to pull a sirloin out of a test tube in anything like a cost-effective way.
Well, Lucius makes some excellent points, and I can validate that by saying the first prototype of a in vitro meat burger is going to cost over $300,000. So, yes,
no thanks.
it's not I'll economically pass. Viable right now. But the researchers who are undertaking this project recognize that this is to lab-grown meat what a mainframe computer in the 60s is to a handheld computer today.
But isn't it always going to take those inputs he's describing, which, are often animal themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. It's not going to be feasible until they get a plant-based culture. And that is – there's in the book, I've spent some time in the Netherlands, and I visited a lab in Amsterdam, which is focusing on trying to get an affordable culture. And in fact, what the caller, Lucius, pointed out, yes, it's extraordinarily expensive to use a fetal bovine serum, mm-hmm. which is used in labs. Not to mention that's against the whole no-kill spirit of in vitro meat. One of the things that's appealing about it is the idea that you could use a single stem cell to, provide protein needs for a huge population. So, yes, he's addressing all issues with it, but I would say – let's keep on trying. If this is an avenue that could potentially reduce the weight on the land and could provide protein in a safe way, let's explore it. And not to mention, one of the things about this lab engineered burger, which may be slightly increase the appeal to some of the listeners, is there's the possibility that you could engineer it so it doesn't create heart attacks. You could take out the bad fats and replace it with good omega-3 fatty acids, so that it could have the fat profile of an avocado. So there are some benefits to, at least exploring it, even though it's in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. We hear, Lucius, your sharp skepticism there. But Josh, I read you kind of envisioning, or at least some people in the field envisioning it way down the road somewhere where people have their own little, like restaurants, maybe with their own meat grower back behind the kitchen.
Yes, yes. If there's, progress in developing the technology and, just like with other technologies where they become disseminated and smaller, the idea would be that this could be happening at a smaller scale in restaurants and in eventually in the home.
Wow. Here's our bread maker. Here's our meat grower. But Lucius, skepticism noted. Beth in Lansing, Michigan. Beth, you're very patient. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a quote from Albert Einstein that is just so simple, but I think so profound, and that is nothing will benefit human health and increase the chances for survival of life on Earth as much as the evolution to a vegetarian diet. And that's from Albert Einstein.
Right. So let's go vegetarian and maybe not worry so much about the meat grower in the basement. What about it, Josh, the vegetable side of your equation, 2035?
Totally agree. I totally agree with that. I think if there's any impact that this book experience has had on me, I feel far guiltier that I'm such a meat eater. I agree that a vegetarian diet is a positive step, and I admire vegetarians and vegans far more than I did in the past. This is a techno a solution, accepting that there is a hunger in this world for animal protein.
And you admire because of its lighter footprint on the land.
Exactly.
What about bugs?
I mean, bugs are, you know, if there's anything that could potentially have a higher yuck factor than in vitro meat, it may be bugs, at least among Westerners in America and Northern Europe. But bugs also have a lot of – have a great sustainability logic. You know, they're high in protein. They're low in fat. They're climate friendly. They don't produce the greenhouse gas emissions that animal livestock does. It's and also, you know, much of the world has no problem with insects. You know, it's something like 80% of the world's countries are insect eaters. Now, it's very, very early, but you can already see the beginnings of an embrace of insects in avant-garde American restaurants, such as Jose Andres, who is the James Beard Chef of the Year, I think it was last year, in D.C., has been serving a very popular Oaxacan grasshopper taco at his restaurant. And you're also beginning to see some entrepreneurs in the Netherlands, which has always been – seems to be very concerned about their protein problem. Mm-hmm. You can buy a variety of different insect-based products in their equivalent of Costco. So I really do think that insects are also going to be part of the menu of the future.
How's it hit your palate? And is it always recognizable as insect flesh, if that's the right word, or are they just ground up and turned into, I don't know, bugger burgers?
They could be, you know, one of the early entrepreneurs who is here in Chicago is grinding them up and is serving them in patties so that they're – or at least I don't know if they're available now, but so that they wouldn't be recognizable as bugs, but it would just be using the material and creating it into something familiar like
and,
a hamburger.
Grinding up what kind of – I mean, does it matter? Like, just whatever bugs on the windowsill, or do you want a certain larvae, or what makes a good patty?
I believe it was a mealworm. I'll have to double check that. But a mealworm burger.
Oh, yeah.
Yummy.
Brian in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's your question, Brian?
Well, it's kind of pessimistic, but what about the Soylent Green scenario?
Eat each other?
Well, if things keep going the way they are, with global warming, I mean, the movie's quite prophetic since it came from the early 70s.
Charlton Heston and scooping human bodies up and turning them into that kind of burger. What do you say to that pessimism, Josh?
I am far more optimistic, both from, you know, what we're seeing in terms of the, you know, the on-the-ground farm movement like your earlier caller and the potential of technology to improve crop production. And, I think that I don't envision a Soylent Green situation.
You're wild for lettuce and all of its cousins. You talk about a blue lettuce out of Afghanistan and all kinds of – I mean, we've already had a huge evolution on that front since we got all the packaged salad greens of the last decade and more. What do you see coming on the salad front? It's a third of your book. You're really into it.
Yes, I did spend, I guess, what some people would say is an eccentric amount of time in the future of salad. This goes back to what you might remember, Tom, is 10, 15 years ago when there was, for me, there was lettuce involved, one type of lettuce. It was iceberg lettuce.
Just watch out, Titanic. Here it is.
And then at some point, there was this revolution in the 90s, and arugula, and frisée, and oak leaf, and red leaf. And, you know, the salad became, whenever I thought about beginning this book and thought back to, like, what's an example of a revolution that has made an impact on me, it was always that, because that had just a qualitative improvement on my life.
And this is when out in the Salinas Valley, they started figuring out how to package and clean and ship out all kinds of greens that just weren't in most supermarkets before widely.
Yeah, one of the surprising things is when I was poking around and talking with people in Salinas and in the salad industry, I was very surprised to find out that one of the things that made this revolution possible was actually the bag itself. In order to make it possible to have spring green mixes, in order to, you know, enable the type of shelf life which could lead to the downfall of the iceberg empire. You know, you needed to have a bag which could foster that shelf life. And that in itself, I discovered, was a tremendous feat that required a whole host of people with titles such as post-harvest physiologists,
right,
and polymer chemists.
And a lot.
And,
a lot,
it took over 20 years, you know, to actually refine the breathable bag.
A lot more of that coming. So you're juggling all these things. We just got half a minute here. Josh, but what do you think? 2035, and you've got test tube meat, and you've got cobia growing in the fish tank in the basement, and you've got all kinds of enhanced foods of different kinds and new things on the menu from sub-Saharan Africa, and maybe a little insect, you know, mealworm meal in there. Are we happy at the dinner table in 2035, by and large, or grossed out?
Well, I think that there's going to be a continual hunger for something better, something more, just as that is human nature. But I think, I think that the future could be a bright spot for both foodies and for, you know, people who need more food currently.
Well,
yeah, I'm optimistic about the future.
We'll be looking out for it, for your goosey soup and baobab juice and Zanzibari pizza. And the rest, we're tiptoeing gently, but you've opened our eyes here. Josh Schoenwald's new book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Foodie. Joined us from Chicago. Josh, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Listeners, really excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Josh, thanks again. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.